Good morning. Good morning, everyone. In the absence, as per standing rule 772, in the absence of the chair and the deputy chair from a meeting, the committee must elect of its members to be acting chairperson at the meeting. I'll take nominations now.
Thank you. I nominate Member Wiley.
Any further nominations? Okay, Mr. Wiley, a seconder. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wiley.
Good morning, everybody. In the absence of the chairperson, Mr. Joseph, who is on personal leave at the moment, he asked Mr. Moncasero to sit in, but he's caught in traffic. So I thought it's time that he arrives. I will do the honours, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Treasury here this morning, Mr. Hussain, and you and your department. This is a presentation of the quarterly report. I think, with the exception of the lady at the back there, which is Honourable Member Wendy Philander, who is a new member of Parliament, and we welcome you, Ms. Philander, here to this sitting. Welcome all the other members here, and Mr. Hussain, I think for the benefit of Ms. Philander, if you'll introduce your team and then get on with your presentation, please. Mr. Hussain, sorry.
Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the members. Thanks for the opportunity to present on the quarter one results for the province of the Western Cape. Chair, it is a joint session that was run between Provincial Treasury and the Department of the Premier, specifically the non-financial performance information. Chair, if it's okay with you, we can just do a round of introductions for the team, and then we can ask the speaker to commence with the presentation when we're ready. So, back to you, Stan, your department.
Rebel leader from Treasury.
Good morning, welcome, Western Provincial Treasury.
Good morning, Annalise Speck, Provincial Government Finance.
Good morning, Senate Ishmael, Department of the Premier.
Good morning, Gerald Barnard, Department of the Premier.
Good morning, Paul Pienaar, Treasury.
Good morning, Klaas Langenhuizen, Treasury.
Good morning, Dr. Mandela, Treasury.
Can I get your name? Sorry, say it again. Thank you.
Good morning, Renalina, Provincial Treasurer.
Thank you very much for those introductions. Mr. Hussain, be in your hands.
Chair, maybe just to note the apology of Ms. Cantana, and then Staff of the Minister has also ended an apology for today's meeting. And Liz?
Thank you, Chair. So we're here to present the first quarter for the 18-19 financial year on both on the performance outcomes, both from a financial perspective as well as in terms of the ATP target deliverables. And so when you look at from the finance side, in terms of a summary of overall expenditure of all the votes that make up the 62 billion rand budget. For the Western Cape Government. For the first quarter, we spent about 21% of our budget, and as at the 30th of June, we are showing in terms of a technical over-expenditure, projected over-expenditure of about 42 million rand, consisting mainly within the Department of Health at the 36 million rand that we can see there, and then also in terms of Provincial Parliament is showing an 8 million rand technical overspending, as well as within the agriculture sector in terms of a technical overspending. Now, the reason why we're putting this as a technical overspending is as part of the first quarter for the financial year, the departments have put in applications for rollover of the previous financial year. So what they've been done is in terms of they've shown that applications as over expenditure. So it's technical from a perspective in terms of that we are going through that process as the stage. And once approved, it will be taken up in the adjustments estimate, and therefore the overspending will be dealt with. And that's why we're saying it from a technical perspective. We're also saying in terms of at this stage, the over expenditure, even though at 30th of June, we're going through the processes within health in terms of the 36 million you see overspending there was mainly on the health revitalization grant, on conditional grants, and that has subsequently been approved by the National Treasury, and therefore it won't need the application doesn't impose to the fiscus. So that has been approved. Then further also in terms of provincial parliament, that is really in terms of the enterprise risk management system that has been that's been rolled out, and that is in terms of a rollover application that was made that the speaker has consequently and subsequently approved, and so that is also in terms of will be taken care of in terms of the adjustments estimate. Looking at the provincial treasury, at this stage the provincial treasury is showing an underspending of 7.4 million, and that is mainly on COE, and the reason for that is really the movement of staff that has happened since the beginning of the financial year, as well as the deferment of the graduate program in terms of, number one, the deferment from potential graduates, asking for deferment to next year and year to come, as well as in terms of the decrease therefore in the uptake of the graduates on the program in the current financial year. Within transport, sorry, in terms of agriculture, agriculture's overspending that has been indicated is mainly in terms of drought relief measures, which is also part of the rollover process that is currently on its way. And that drought relief measure is mainly in terms of the Mitsukama municipality. And so that will also be dealt with as part of the adjustment estimate process. Further in terms of that slide that then gives you in terms of also from an economic classification perspective in terms of how that spending is made up, and also in terms of how the projections going forward is made up. In essence, I have dealt with this slide and the next one in terms of explanation for all of them. So moving on to the public entities, and when we look at the public entity slide, you see that of the 3 billion rand budget that our 8 entities have been appropriated, they have spent 713 million. Of the 690 million rand, sorry, main budget of the public entities of all 8, they have spent also on par with the province. They spent about 22% of their budget thus far. So they spent 151 million of the 690 million rand budget. And at this stage, you'll see that the Westgro as well as Cape Nature are showing in terms of underspending is mainly related in terms of Cape Nature on cost of employees, and that is in terms of the delayed processing back pay as well as notch increases. So once that actually takes place, that projected underspending will decrease in the future. As well as on a capital project in terms of the Kochelberg Nature Reserve, they've also in terms of having slower rollout of the project, which has caused some delays in terms of projection or underspending. And then when we look at Westgro, the 903 underspending is really in terms of at this stage it's just a projection, but in terms of spending by Westgro, you see that they have spent almost 45% of the budget, but the spending includes in terms of mostly training fees, annual subscription fees, which is annual, so obviously it's paid up front for the entire year. And then also there's some fees that they needed to pay upfront for marketing, monitoring and research going forward. When we look at our provincial own receipts, thus far our provincial own receipts, we have collected 822 million of the 3 billion rand budget. That amounts to about 27% of our collection thus far. And as in terms of the drivers of the revenue, it is our motor vehicle license fees, our health patient fees within health, and then also on the provincial treasury side, it is our gambling taxes, both on the casino as well as horse racing on the receipt side. On the infrastructure side, you can see from our 8 billion rand budget for the 18-19 financial year, each of the sectors, what they have spent. In aggregate, they spent 14%, or collectively they spent 14% of the budget thus far. And in terms of in terms of spending that for their well-being amongst the children. The non-financial information, Ms. Ishmael will deal with. The format and the structure of the sheet in that presented it shows that we have broken down the departments in terms of for the first quarter in terms of clusters, which is from the top the governance, the social and economic cluster, and then one look at the departments with the normal with the columns that we usually show, and then what we have done in addition to the columns that we normally show, we actually done two columns. We actually said the annual year to date. It actually shows that what is the progression of where the departments are in terms of achieving their total targets. That is a question that came up previously, so we try to present a picture to demonstrate will the departments eventually achieve the total targets. Noting there that in a particular quarter they may overachieve or underachieve. When one looks at the clusters and one looks at the governance, then you can see that the total number of targets achieved. For the Department of Premier is 89%, Treasury 90%, and local government is 95%, well beyond the average of 78% across the department. We want to get the social cluster, the picture is slightly different and it kind of varies from overachievers above the average of Western Cape government to actually below the average of Western Cape government, which is 78%. Education has achieved all their targets, and community safety, and also cultural affairs and sports. But when one look at the Department of Health, Social Development, and Human Settlement, then one actually see a different picture where they actually only achieve 69%, 63% and 67% respectively, noting that the average of the achievement across the departments are 78%. When one look at the economic cluster, then you actually see that agriculture just beyond the average achieves 76%. Economic development 95%, transport and public works 50%, while below the 78%, and the environmental affairs and development planning 60%. When one look at your annual year to date, then the first column actually showing where we are currently now. If one look at the total cumulative targets that the department needs to achieve across the quarter one, quarter two, quarter three, and quarter four, and you look at where they are now, preliminary, it gives a picture of what is the proportion of achievement towards your annual target. So you can start seeing if a department is in risk or not in risk. Right? This is the first time we're actually doing this comparison based on the request of the Budget Committee. And it's not perfect, and we ourselves are actually seeing where we can improve in presenting this data. So if one look at the department and you look at the year to date, then you could see slight discrepancies in terms or variances in comparison to the preliminary and the performance. And you could actually see where the departments are actually on par. So the only
in the governance cluster, you could actually see they're quite on par. So preliminary, they achieve example 28%. They're supposed to achieve 25%. So it's slightly kind of a overachievement, but one shouldn't lose sight of the number of targets not achieved, or the number of targets partially achieved. So the percentage can also be misleading. One need to look at the number of targets not achieved and the number of targets partially achieved also. And is that and the type of targets that's at risk. Okay. So if one moves to the following that's also supporting information, if one looks at the preliminary performance, the structure and the format of the sheet is exactly the same. So we'll go straight into the entity, and if one look at the governance cluster, there's only one entity, which is the Western Cape Gambling and Racing Board, and they have achieved 92% of the target, right? Which means they have achieved 11 out of the 12 targets. If one look at the social cluster, the Western Cape Heritage, the Western Cape Language Board and the Western Cape Cultural Commission will achieve 100% of the target, and then the Western Cape Liquor Authority will make 82% of the target. If one look at the economic cluster, the Western Cape Tourism and Trade achieve 100% of the target, Saldanha Bay 100%, and Western Cape the Nature Board also 100%. Cathedral only 68%. So while the average across the entities in terms of percentage of target achieved 85%, there are two entities that actually achieved below that average, and that is the Western Cape Liquor Authority and Cathedral. When one look at the annual year to date, then in governance they're actually quite on par, the same with the social cluster. Perhaps the Western Cape Cultural Commission a little ahead in terms of where they should be, in terms of kind of overachieving. And then one look at the economic cluster. There's a kind of an anomaly there, and I'm highlighting the anomaly, that the Western Cape Tourism and Trade Investment have actually achieved all the targets already for the year, and they're only in quarter one. And there are reasons for that, and we can actually share that reasons where they actually said that they had many other opportunities which they grabbed, and the detail of that we could share. So one of the lessons learned is instead of showing 215, if anything has been achieved above 100%, rather than not give a figure, because the percentage can be misleading. So that is one of the things that we will improve on. And then the same thing it is for Saldanha. So the average across the entities were 85%, and only two entities have actually achieved below that average. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Schwab. Mr. Manila, you want to add to that?
Chair, maybe just to, remind the members, obviously our role is to report the information. The detail sits in the departments, in the various committees, and then in addition to this information, we provided all the CDs and everything to all the members of Parliament. So as an example, if you want to interrogate Treasury as a vote, that goes to the SCOF, and obviously to deal with the stuff in all the respective committees. And there's obviously a quest from, I think, from our side to improve the kind of reporting to this committee on a quarterly basis.
You're trying to have a peace-loving Friday, are you?
Absolutely.
All right. First of all, thank you very much for those two presentations. I must admit that every time I attend these meetings, I see improvements all along the way. The schematics you put up there are an improvement. It's broken it down into the three different groupings, and it's now idiot-proof as far as the bars are concerned. There are some red lights, as you can see, which I'm sure that the various chairpersons are now going to take up with their respective departments, but it's a significant improvement. It is still the first quarter, so it's very much early days, and I'm sure there'll be catch-up coming on. However, can I ask from my side before we ask the members, are there any of those departments that got heavy red bars at the moment that are seriously far behind in your estimation, seriously far behind in the beginning of their projects as to why they're not reaching their targets? If I could just get an overview, I'm not quite sure what to be said. If there's anybody that's brave enough to want to answer that. Thanks, Mr. Molina.
Chair, I think it's first quarter, you contextualised it. I'm not concerned at this stage from a treasury perspective around, you know, even the financials and the non-financials. Obviously, as we go into the second and third quarter, some of the stuff will be defined. And what you generally get in the first quarter, you can go to any of those departments, is that a lot of those things that's been partially achieved have actually been achieved now, probably in the first or the second month of the second quarter, because a lot of it is to do with either issues of compliance or certain projects that's probably been 80% plus completed. So from where we're sitting as a treasury, we don't have any major concerns at this point in time. And I think slide 15 is actually a good indication, maybe for the chairpersons of those various committees, you know, whether it's on environment, member Schaefer, whether it's on DDEC, deals with the economic stuff, or human settlements, is maybe to ask those particular questions in there, because there will be particular reasons. In the case of human settlements, a lot of it is to do with EIA approvals, etc. But there's no major risk or sense of getting from our side at this point in time that the departments would not achieve the majority of the indicators as per the APP. And even I think on the financial side, as Annelies has indicated, those are all technical underspendings, which is in fact covered by rollover applications. And what we do in our oversight responsibilities, I mean, we zoom into these numbers per department as part of our quarterly engagements. We, on the eve of having our MTEC assessments, where we interrogate both the performance, financial and non-financial, and if there's any issue there, we bring it normally to this committee during November when we deal with the adjustment estimate. So from a, I think, delivery perspective, there's no concern.
Okay, then I'm going to ask the committee members if they have any questions specifically with regard to the matter. I mean, the long and the short of it is that being the first quarter, you do need to ask your relevant HODs and the, well, through the minister, ask the HODs about the red bars, just to get an assurance that they are going to kick off those projects. I'm not so worried about the partially not achieved, because often that is just a incremental miss. It's just a minor miss, but it's the ones that haven't kicked off that you need to ask the questions on, especially in the first quarter, because by the time you get to the second and the third and the fourth quarter, it becomes a compounded issue. But any questions from your side, Mr. Chacha, followed by Mr. Mazzoli, and then what? Are you waiting at me? Okay, better you can be safe. Okay, sorry, I did see Mr. Chacha first. It's a bit far from me.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me welcome the report, Chairperson. I think I have two questions. The first one is on page 3, in relation to the what you call as a rollover, yeah, expenditure or rollover that might appear. And one, you mentioned the issue of drought as amongst other problems that you might have rollovers. So I just want to understand from the type of rollover, what has not been achieved in terms of drought, particularly in this period, that needs to be given a rollover in order to be sorted in the next quarter. Because what I would want to understand is that particular or type of work that's supposed to be done affecting current production, so that
That's the first initial chair. And then I hear the explanation that some of the under expenditure might have been covered now. I just want to, from you, just to get an assurance that we won't come at the end of the year. We still have vacancies that were not been able to be filled, because that's what we got, for instance, in the last financial year, where we come at the end of the year with problems of vacancies that are not able to, not because of the restrictions that have been set by Treasury or National Treasury, but because this or that of departments were not able to fill those vacancies. So I just want to get that, I know that we have to ask the HODs at the end of the day in when we are interacting with our departments. Okay, over the two.
Sheta?
I just firstly want to make a comment. I think over the last time, we're almost heading into 5 years of this term, you really do get to know your departments very well. So, you know, while I don't want to at any way underline our oversight, you know when your departments are on track or not. And with agriculture, we learned over the years that it's a moving target because it's real life stuff. So, you know, it's always a delayed reaction, and we always go at the end of the year and go, oh, why haven't you met those targets? Well, the targets are moving because it's drought and it's fencing and it's floods. So, Chair, I really do think that we don't, in my opinion at this point, although I will question what those are. I mean, if I link it up, I can see that Cathedra's also done four targets not achieved. Cathedra's our implementation agency with agriculture. It makes sense. They're busy with projects and they delay. It's very normal. So I agree, there's not a cause for concern in these two departments. Thank you.
Okay, but that's well and good, but the point is we are oversight, and you must ask the questions, because the problem is, and we've seen it before, once you start getting muck with the departments, then things start to slip, and by the time you realize it, we've got a problem. So, you're very defensive.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. My own interest would be on the quality of the achievements, on the quality of the targets, because it's always very impressive to see performance, but you need to do qualitative performance assessment. So that's what I'll be focusing on, so that we don't just tick the boxes. I only have one target that has not been achieved, and that is 5%, but I'm quite happy with the performance. But to get the quality, I will engage the department. The other interest would be, obviously, I'm sure that Chairperson will deal with these issues. I think at this committee, if you look at the number of targets partially achieved, I think that should flag those particular areas. Why are they not fully achieved? Will they be able to achieve all of these targets on time for the next assessment? So I think, Chair, thank you very much. That's my only input on this one.
Okay, thank you for that. Before I ask the department, I just want for the benefit of the member, Philander, one of the things that we do find, and this is where in the annual report process, where you're measuring the APPs against the annual report, is that if you feel the departments are setting very low targets, in other words, they're too easy to achieve, that's where the standing committee comes in and says, increase the targets, make a little bit more onerous, because just achieving simple targets isn't certain, increasing service delivery out in the public. The partially achieved point that Member Mankasilik raised makes is quite correct. But however, we must also bear in mind that there's a template that they follow, and you either achieve 100% or you don't achieve. So even if they get 99%, it's going to be partially achieved. So that we must also bear in mind. It's a template, unfortunately, that runs through the whole system. Is that correct? Melinda, isn't that correct?
Yeah. Okay. Chair, I mean, it is true, and I think that what is important is the part that you touched on is actually the impact of these targets. And I mean, there is an opportunity for all departments to reflect on it in the annual report, in terms of, okay, so we've set these targets, what is the reflection of in terms of the outcome and the impact, obviously, of this work. So, it's really just moving beyond the quantitative aspects of the report and moving into the quality of the members as indicated.
Questions? Points raised?
Chair, sorry, just maybe on that, I would like Ronald just to respond because he's the head of the budget office. I think the point that the member's making is exactly where we need to go as government. And in fact, it's currently a work in progress, but I've asked Ashley to respond to this, maybe just some ideas.
Thank you. We are all in agreement that we need to look at the quality of the performance of the department on a quarterly basis as well, in addition to the work that is being done by the SMI at DOT-P, with the figures that they are showing to you now on the presentation. However, we are looking at how that can be done. We do it for the PGM tax, of course, every single year, but that can be implemented on a quarterly basis when we look at the quality of the performance of the department. But for the next round of presentations, we could put some kind of qualitative analysis on the presentation for you, definitely.
Respond to the question on the drought and the impact.
All right, so in terms of the part what the rollover, and I'm dealing now with the agriculture rollover that the question was asked, part of the rollover is in terms of the services in most instance, because that is the rules of rollover, you cannot apply for rollover if the services have not happened in the previous financial year. It is just in terms of waiting for the invoices and therefore to make the payments. So what I want to assure the member in terms of where drought is concerned, this is the thing that Treasury did check in terms of when we did our oversight roles, of when, especially in drought, whether the actual service happened. Because obviously the nature of the drought, and we're talking about, especially where this is concerned, it is in terms of drilling of boreholes and making sure that water is available, not only to agri workers on the farms, but also in terms of the agricultural sector along the Matsikama municipality, in the terms of that canal. So I can assure you that actually happened, but in terms of this, it's just a technical in terms of now it's the paying of the invoices in the next financial year. So that is what we're talking about on the drought side. I think in the end, in terms of the question in terms of vacancies and the members asking in terms of assurances, in terms of underspending on vacancies, I think as a Treasury, I don't know if we can give you the assurances of underspending on vacancies, but I can tell you in terms of as a Treasury, what we do know that for 18-19 is that we need to make that underspending on COE as little as possible. We were 0.6%. Of our underspending last year in 17-18 of our COE budget. The idea is to decrease that even more going forward. The what we do find is in terms of COE, it is the nature of it when people actually are going to resign, that is not within the control, unfortunately, of management. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that they are nimble in terms of their reaction period when they do have vacancies, in terms of to decrease the time it takes to fill those posts again, because that's where the most of the underspending actually occurs. So I also think I just want to indicate in terms of when I spoke about underspending on COE, it was on the voter of the Treasury, and so I also need to give you some insight in terms of how that actually could be. So I said it is in terms of the undergrad program and the deferment. So for example, the Provincial Treasury budgeted to take on 42 new graduates in tax for the year. What actually happened in terms of those who actually took them up was only 29. But 42 would have qualified in terms of the contractual agreement, if they did meet all the contractual agreements. And so what the Treasury needs to do is obviously we need to make sure in terms of the budgeting, because that is part of the contract, that those that if they would have fulfilled the contract, we need to budget for that, but only 29 took that up. You will ask them, as not the Treasury Department, but as Public Finance, as the Treasury now having oversight over the department. You can see my HOP HOD right now is looking at me and smiling. Obviously, the question is to ask the Treasury now, how do you improve on those projections going forward? It is a new program that they are doing, so they need to learn from that. And obviously, every year we need to get them to improve their budgeting going forward. Thank you, Chair.
Questions?
That's what you were saying, the time that you have spent for all the departments, 0.8 or what is the target in terms of that? So that at the end of the year we're able to say, this is the target of the department.
Chair is not often that I get put on the spot, but like I said, 0.6% is what we did last year, underspending on the CRE. In terms of benchmarks that we say overall in budgeting is usually 0.2%. If you come within 0.2% of your budget, in terms of, we consider that is in terms of a good norm for you to spend. So yes, so without taking the finger off the pulse, I suppose we can say then, I mean, that's when the terms of the treasury will push the department to go.
All right, are there any further questions from the panel, so to speak? Nobody else? All right, then, just a matter of interest, is anybody from AG's office here? Don't they work on the phone? Okay. One point thing from my side, please. Just as far as the austerity measures and the transfer payments are concerned, which are subjects for ongoing threats and so on, is that something that you're able to respond to at this stage as to how that debate is getting on? Because that is going to be a direct threat.
Chair, I think the annual reports are going to be tabled soon, and I think what's probably worthwhile noting is that there is still one department that's got an unresolved dispute in relation to transfer payments. That's correct, yeah. So I think, I would request that maybe that the discussion gets taken up with the relevant executive authority in its presence, so that, simply because the reports have not yet been tabled, so, okay. But it is unresolved, yeah.
We are aware that specific, that problem that has been dealt with specifically by agriculture is now going to become a generic problem. Am I correct?
Chair, without going into the detail, the transfer payment risk has been largely managed across departments. We've set up a specific task team within the provincial territory together with the CFOs to address the matter in May already. And that was to deal with it sort of transversely, as you said, to prevent it from becoming a generic issue. So as far as that matter is concerned, it's been under control for the year under review.
All right, then HOD, to you and your officials, thank you very much. Are you staying, I presume some of you are going to stay now for the FSC. They're only going to get here, they're trying to be here at 10 o'clock, so we're going to break, have a cup of tea. But before, if the officials could break, I just want to finish the minutes now, so we can take a second. And so if we could release you to go down the corridor, have some cup of tea, and you will stay behind. Folks, if we could just please turn to the minutes that were in your pack, and that's the minutes of the 20th of July. You've got a copy? Okay, page 1. Page 2. Okay, any matters up here? Page 2. Okay, so someone who was present at that meeting, please could you nominate proposal? Thank you, that's one. And then Rolanda. Thank you very much. These minutes are now passed unamended, correct? All right, if we could please go and have 15 or whatever your minutes, be back on time at 10 o'clock, hopefully they'll be here. Where were you when I asked page 1? Okay. So were you absent? According to... No. There's no such thing as always having an apology. There's no such thing as you always have an apology if you're not there.
Okay.
Right, so you can pull that one with someone else, but not me. Okay, so the process is, if you have an apology, it is formal, it's in writing, and it's a request. just as far as apologies are concerned, Member Kavita has emailed me or SMS'd me at 4 o'clock this morning to say that he's had to take his wife to hospital, so he probably will be late, and you know. And we also have Mr. Ace and Mr. Vierwankel that gave their apologies. So just that they could go into the record, please. Alright, so we could break for tea, and can I just ask, please, that directly after the FFC presentation, if the DA members, if we could just have a quick, very short this meeting and apologies. With the exception of Ms. Philander, who has given apologies because she has to get to a meeting. Thank you. Okay, apparently there's lunch laid on after the FFC.
What's on the phone at 10 o'clock? I just see my
hair
back. I just
want
to
know. I remember that. But to be there is no apology.
Well, it is.
So apology for to be there. So is that apology?
Yes.
But I'm not going to... Mackenzie, where's Mackenzie?
Mackenzie didn't give me an apology. I'm going to actually check. I'm going to see how
I can get one. Yeah. Apology for Joseph, not apology. Christian. Christian's my son again, who is there.
Thank you.
Was it like to drive, no? From here to those Langebahn to the beach, from the beach?
Mm-hmm.
And
how far?
I cannot say that. I always wanted to go there. I've never been.
I'm going to Paternoster.
What a word, no? That they're always telling me great Christians. Mm. Every day. Like here, for example, they'll sell Chinese grapes or apple pie, because of what the word is when you have it in the party most.
What do you do now, Saraj?
Thank you.
The second presentation, and which is from the FFC, and I'd like to welcome Professor Plaikis and his team here. Thank you very much for being here. Professor, my name is Mark Wiley, but I'm going to be here for about another 30 seconds, so with the blessing of the the meeting, please. I'd like to cede the chair to Member Monticella. If anybody has a problem with that, please. I don't know if they have a problem. All right. Thank you very much. Member Monticella can take the chair.
Alright, good morning, I'm in charge. Please, there's one chairperson. As you know, when I'm given power, I use it. So, thank you, Chief Whip, and thanks, honourable members. Welcome, Prof and his team. You are all now part of us. The presentation that we've received included this document, which we some of the issues that in the previous engagements we raised was how much your input to the National Minister of Finance and various other executive members, how much of that is taken seriously and how much of that gets taken on board as part of their implementation on the overall budget expenditure. So I hope some of the answers will be forthcoming, at least to get a picture or a glimpse of your inner workings there in that space. Over to you, Prof, and thank you once again for your presence here.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. Thank you very much for the opportunity given to us to comply with our constitutional obligatory mandate to present to the provincial legislatures. But it would also be quite useful if you could impress on your metro and also your other municipal councils that part of the responsibility is also to present to them. It seems to me that many of them are not responsive to our request, which we basically do because we don't want to evoke constitutional law on these matters, because I do think that initiatives about the relationship management, relationship building, and then if there's no compliance, we're going to have to call the bluff on the municipality. So I would like you as a collective to consider to put in pressure on the metros, because over the last 2 years we've made recommendations on urban and rural development, and we, notwithstanding the politics that's been going on in your cities, we're not interested in that. We're interested in putting together our submissions are based on the mandate, and we haven't had the opportunity from the city council, from the metro city and also the other councils. So that's the first thing I thought I was going to say. Before I introduce the team, because you just incentivized me to respond to other points. The second thing is that it's actually hard to be able to respond to whether government takes us serious, if provincial government does not take us serious. Because part of our input is to twofold. One, we respond by giving a constitutional submissions a year, 9 months before the time. That's the constitutional responsibility. This is a 9 month period that we do this in the same year, 9 month period. And in that, it requires the provincial legislature to be able to look at what is our provincial government doing in relation to the submission. And then secondly, it then requires us to ensure that what national government is doing in terms of our recommendation. What ostensibly happens, and this is a critical matter that I think this honourable committee needs to think about, is that by giving our responses, the responses to our submissions to the National Treasury, and the National Treasury then collates it on behalf of provinces, there's a classical disjunction in terms of why then we interact with you and still give you responses to national value and provincial treasury. Because we need to get the comments directly from you, even though you also send the comments directly to the national treasury, that's fine. But we need to see exactly what is the provinces, what are the provinces saying through its treasury and its own processes to the submissions that we are making. And that's a critical thing that I think this committee needs to look at. Because in the same way you're asking us whether we are taken seriously in our recommendations, we don't know because we don't get what the Western Cape is saying specifically around our recommendations formally submitted to me or the commissioners, so that we actually see what is the consolidated picture, but also what is the picture that comes from the provinces, in particular the Western Cape. So it's hard to gauge that. The third point I thought is important is when you say I'm taking seriously, I think you need to determine that. Because we're making those recommendations to you as to what we think needs to be in the division of revenue in terms of the budget, but also in terms of the appropriation. During the period up to the budget and post-budget, I listened to all that. The nice thing about the parliamentary channels is you can see what's happening in provincial legislatures. And it's actually a shame that we don't hear provincial legislators actually talking about the recommendations that's been made by the Financial and Fiscal Commission. So provincial legislatures in particular has also failed. I think it's the time that we need to talk quite in terms of good governance and effective governance and government, that provincial legislators also failed in taking up the recommendations that we are making. We were quite definitive over the last 3 years about infrastructure development, what needs to happen on rail, on road transport, on housing, on education, on health, and how infrastructure-led development leads to economic growth. And then we follow them through with specifics around urban development and then on rural development. So taking us seriously is and I'm actually very happy that you're raising it, because I'm saying the same, because I said the same in Limpopo last year, the same in Mpumalanga. It's incumbent on the elected representatives to listen to us and then to see what your provincial treasury provides you, what the national treasury government provides you, and what the FFC is saying. And that requires quite an assessment of it. So as we go along, we will be able to do that. But also it's important that you will see in the treasuries, I will probably be in trouble with a number of people within provincial treasuries and national treasuries, what I've just said to you, but it's fine, because we're doing our constitutional responsibility. But you'll see within the Minister of Finance normally tables a what I call a doorstopper. It's called a budget review in the E&E. Now in the budget review annually, and if you don't have it, and I'm suggesting it, you as a collective, honorable collective, need to look at it. There is a section in it that responds to the recommendations that the FSC has made. And it's part of a table by the Minister of Finance. The shortcoming of that is that it only responds to matters which the Treasury and the Provincial Treasuries have identified as important for them. It doesn't respond on the whole of what we say, because some of the recommendations that we are making, yes, it's on financial and fiscal instruments and the utilization, the utility value of that. But we're also making recommendations on social policies, on intervention in social services and social infrastructure, education, health and welfare, community and family welfare, and interventions that need to be made around that. I mean, in your province in particular, Honourable Chairperson, we know there are the social pathologies are quite frightening, and how families and households are under attack either through gangsterism, criminal activity, criminal-induced activity, and so on and so forth. So we've made some over the years, some substantive interventions in terms of policy inputs around that. Same in education and housing. And then we've also made inputs around economic infrastructure matters and where municipal and provincial responsibilities are. The thing is that just privileging the issues that direct effect on the budget is insufficient, because then the policy interventions in terms of changing, because they, after 20 years the system as it is suggests that we need to relook at how we reconfigure the intergovernmental system, but in particular whether the decentralized system of three levels of municipalities is actually working or not working, whether the way provinces are structured, is it working or not working, and we've made inputs around that. So the point I'm making is that I think it's quite critical that as this collective that it would be useful to see exactly how you see the recommendations made over time. In fact, I'm volunteering that we can even send you a summary, but we can even come back to you, like I said to the last chair, the previous chairperson, to the chairperson, I think Mr.
Joseph.
We even prepared to come back and pin the stuff down in terms of what's in the Western Cape over our last years of recommendations. So I responded to that because I thought it's quite critical to raise. Can I quickly introduce my team before we just like run on this?
First, before you go, thank you for the response to my remarks earlier. Honourable members, it's better when they speak just before they raise the question that they introduce themselves. What I become very uncomfortable with, honourable members, is that you will ask questions when the response is that member with the pink shirt, that member with the folded hair. Eh? We don't want that language in Parliament. We want to maintain the decorum of Parliament, that we refer to members as with their names, they've got names. So if a member ask a question before they do so, they will simply say, I'm Masizole Masela. So it then becomes incumbent on you as the commission to say, Honorable Masela. So if you forget, that is your problem. But I'm going to request that we do so. Some members take a serious offense because we've seen certain things being done terribly wrong, like what I've just said now. And it reduces the decorum, it compromises the decorum of this house. So we need to respect at least this institution so that we don't reduce the standard of Parliament. And I hope we do the same on this side as honourable members. Prof, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members. I can guarantee you the way we've interacted with over the years, we make sure that we write down the honourable member's name and then we respond in that way. We will not devalue the importance of the provincial
level.
Yeah, we'll see that. Thank you. Honourable Chairperson, the members, the staff that's with me is our researchers. Next to me is Ms. Sasa Peters. In fact, if I can just say that we've brought our Western Cape team with office, because we've got two offices, offices in Cape Town, offices in the Drang. So this is the Western Cape think tank. So Ms. Sasa Peters sits next to me, she's going to lead the presentation. And then next to her is Shen Wei Cheng. You probably know him, he used to be in the provincial government, in the Treasury. We've got next to him Mr. Khalid Dawood. And at the back, I've got Poppy Ntaka and Henry Eckstein, who's our parliamentary and legislature liaison office. Chairperson, this presentation that we're bringing to you is called Reengineering the Intergovernmental System in a Fiscally Constrained Environment for National Development. It is positioned against fiscal constraint, but also positioned against the whole thing about financial containment, and also given the slow growth that has been affecting the country. And in reality, the slow growth has actually made less space for any new fiscal interventions that needs to be made in terms of
financing various programs and that. So we're bringing this submission also to you in terms of Section 214 of the Constitution, Section 9 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, and also Section 4.4c of the Municipal Amendments, sorry, Monetary Money Imposed Amendment Proceedings at this Act. Our focus is then specifically on the review of effectiveness and performance of the government fiscal relations system and make recommendations to re-engineering the fiscal instruments, incentives and other measures to address challenges to achieve national plan objectives. We focused, as I've mentioned, on infrastructure growth, which was then followed by rural development and urban development. Before I forget, we're working on our 2020-21 submission. We're starting to unbundle the whole municipal system and looking at restoring public finance within municipalities, given what's currently going on across the country. So we're looking forward to that engagement with the provincial administration, but also with you afterwards when we've done our things. This submission, we're going to fast track you through it. We're looking at re-engineering the governmental system. We're going to look at the re-centralization of implications for service delivery, the provincial fiscal adjustment mechanisms in terms of protracted fiscal constraints. Therein we're going to look at especially what's happening in health. We will also take you through quickly through the incentive effects of intergovernmental grants, and we look at what are we learning from the municipalities. Assessing efficiencies of key provincial infrastructure programs, and then we start looking at the case of education, health and public transport, and then lastly the effectiveness of intergovernmental fiscal relations instruments in addressing the water challenges. Just to ask your permission up front, what we will do is, if it's in order with you, that I will call out the staff member that's doing the section, and just to fast track you to it, so without stopping and asking you every time, can I allow this person to present? And then there will be, at different times, one of your foremost staff will then at different times give an input on different matters, so that we also make the picture more real to the Western Cape province.
That's helpful. That's welcome on my side. To feel comfortable to proceed as you wish.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Prof.
Sasa Peters.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee, as well as other colleagues. I'll take you through chapter one of our submission, and this chapter is. Sorry, Chair, we're having a bit of.
It's not moving.
Moving the
smile. I can tell you that skill I don't have. Where are the people who have helped us? Is it moving now?
I'll just indicate when it must be moving. Thank you, Chair. So chapter one is the scene-setting chapter of our submission document, and it essentially contextualizes the economic environment that we find ourselves in, and it makes proposals on how we should proceed in order to move to a more optimal growth trajectory that is better able to support our National Development Plan goals of reducing poverty and also inequality by 2030. So in terms of our macroeconomic outlook, South Africa has been slow to recover from the effects of the global financial crisis that commenced in 2007 and 2008. So the economy has just been unable to reach the robust pre-crisis growth rates that we saw, the growth rates of around 4.5 to 5% that characterized the period 1998 to 2008.
So as a result of this, there's been a narrowing of fiscal space, which means that that flexibility that government would have had in its spending choices has been diminishing. And this has culminated in a fiscal constraint, which gives rise to the need for government to make very tough and delicate decisions around the prioritization of its plans and programs. If we move to the next slide, this figure just graphically illustrates South Africa's growth performance in relation to three things. Firstly, overall global growth, which is the blue bar. It shows South Africa's growth relative to growth in emerging economies, which is the green bar, as well as our growth in relation to growth in sub-Saharan Africa, which is the yellow bar. And what is clear is that over that 10-year period reflected in the figure, we have lagged behind in terms of a growing global economy as well as our emerging market peers. We've just been unable to leverage the interlinkages that exist in the global economy. Now, the effects of low growth and the resultant widening of the deficit means that each year, the budgets that have been tabled have merely just pushed out the date at which we will be able to reduce the size of the deficit. So the result is that funds which are critically needed for development are now increasingly becoming tied up in interest payments. And if we look at the figures, we see that over the next 3 years, interest payments are set to grow at a real annual average of around 4.6%, whereas your non-interest expenditure is set to grow only by 1.7%. Now, the non-interest expenditure is the money that goes to the different spheres of government and is really used to effect service delivery. That is only projected to grow by a small 1.7%. Your interest payments are really crowding out what resources could have been allocated in respect of service delivery. So fiscally speaking, we are also beset by revenue under-collection. The 2018 budget projects a revenue shortfall of around 48.2 billion for 2017-18. We face with a narrow tax base and overextended government structures, which means that government agencies are often they are underfunded. So if we move to the next slide. So the question is how, in this constrained economic environment, can we revise our macroeconomic aggregates or targets so that we have a better chance at meeting our national development goals, especially around poverty and inequality. And based on our simulations, and what is really the key message from this chapter is that continuing with the business as usual approach, continuing with what we do right now with respect to our interventions and our policies, will not help us in meeting our 2030 targets. So specifically with respect to economic growth, our analysis shows that we need to move from the current level of 2% to 4.5%. And one of the ways that we can achieve higher growth is through investment. And what our analysis suggests is that investment will have to increase from the current 3% to 5.7% if we are going to attain a higher level of growth. Then with respect to inequality, our analysis shows that skilled and highly skilled labour markets offer better employment and earning opportunities, especially in your more rural areas. So your skills development programs are your best around meeting these income inequality targets. And what the rest of the submission now does is it focuses on how aspects of the intergovernmental fiscal relations system can be re-engineered, as Macheperson indicated, so that within this constrained fiscal environment, that we can stay the course for meeting those national development goals by 2030. If I may hand over to my colleague, please.
Honourable Chairperson, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen of the House, with the backdrop of a protracted, decelerated economic growth, narrowing fiscal space and weakened governance, as the IMF alarmingly concluded in the 2018 Article 4 consultation, and I quote, some of South Africa's economic and social achievements after the end of apartheid have recently unborn. Today in this house, the natural questions are, in that order, firstly, where is Western Cape Province positioned in this difficult economic and fiscal environment? This is answered in this provincial profile information annexure. Secondly, what has been the impact on the fiscal framework of the Western Cape as expressed in the Divisional Revenue Bill, that is this memo on the Western Cape fiscal framework, and finally, for which the Financial and Fiscal Commission, as per its constitutional mandate, submits its recommendation, that is this annual Financial and Fiscal Commission submission for the Division of Revenue. So, therefore,
yes,
we have the copies of those documents.
Yes, we do. Yeah, most of this, in fact, the book was distributed to all of our members. That's why I have it here. So this one, I don't have it here in front of me, but most of this was circulated by email. But you can wait for it until you get it now, and then we can proceed. Please excuse us, Mr. Chair.
My apologies as well. Therefore, table on this slide presents the social economic evidence as share of households with access to services in the Western Cape and other provinces. Color coding from red to green is relative among provinces from low to high levels of access. Data evidence shows that Western Cape ranks favorably in basic services of improved water, sanitation and refuse, medium rank in terms of access to schools and transport. However, Western Cape is medium to low rank in terms of RDP or state subsidized house and housing subsidy, and on the low end in terms of access to formal dwellings, suggesting a need for greater focus on infrastructure and the relevant infrastructure conditional grants such as the provincial road maintenance grants, education infrastructure grants and hospital revitalization grants. In particular, human settlements development grants, notwithstanding the new Title Deed restoration grants derivative, had been reduced by 370.3 million in the 2018-19 financial year and 447.5 million between the 2017 and 18 budget baseline in the province. More of these details could be found in the Western Cape Fiscal Framework Memo. Next slide. Chapter 2 of the FEC submission for the 2019-20 Divisional Revenue is on fiscal re-centralization, implications for service delivery and intergovernmental fiscal relations. By way of introduction, supported by empirical evidence, table presents the comparison between the 2017 and 18 budgets for the 2018-19 and 2019-20 financial years by spheres of government, that is national, provincial and local. The data showed that provincial and local spheres of government, especially provincial and local conditional grants, bear the brunt of the fiscal consolidation effort in the 2018-19 financial year. More specifically, total appropriation by national votes, basically national sphere of governments before direct charges, was only reduced by 1.568 billion in the 2018 budget compared to the 2017 budget for the 2018-19 financial year. In contrast, provincial equitable share was reduced by 1.236 billion and provincial conditional grants a 6.381 billion reduction for the same financial year. Of the total 9.983 billion total fiscal consolidation efforts achieved for that year. In the 2019-20 financial year, data suggests that additional funding for national departments of 17.7 billion mainly for higher education and training, and the total main budget expenditure reduction of 19.621 billion are mainly the result of money reprioritized from provisional allocation for contingencies not assigned to votes at 12.3 billion, a reduction of contingency reserve at 12 billion, as well as reductions in the provincial equitable share and conditional grants at 1.084 billion and 7.553 billion respectively. Hence, the fiscal re-centralization literally showing up in the numbers. I now hand over to Poppy to present on Chapter 2, Fiscal Re-Centralization and its Implications.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee and other colleagues. As previously said, Chapter 2 of the submission concerns re-centralization, where re-centralization is essentially a reform that brings about a reduction in the autonomy of subnational government, so it basically refers to an increasing role and control by national governments, where examples of re-centralization or of national government expanding its footprint include the shifting of functions from subnational government to the national sphere, or in a financial sense, it occurs when there's a reduction in the autonomy of subnational governments over their fiscal resources. So when we see excessive use of conditional grants relative to the streams of revenue that subnational government has discretion on how to use. Now, re-centralization is often based on the perception that government is better at service delivery or at ensuring that results are achieved. And from our analysis, it appears that governments are more prone to re-centralize during times of fiscal stress. However, re-centralization raises various concerns. One such concern is that it runs contrary to the spirit and the principles underpinning the multi-level system of government. So if it was the case that national government were expanding its footprint or its role and the results was improved, more cost-effective service delivery, but this was happening at the same time as the upscaling of subnational government capacity, then maybe we could justify national government having a larger role. Another concern is that with re-centralization, the relocation of functions come with definite financial implications for both the sphere gaining and the one losing the function. So with that, the key question of this chapter looked at whether re-centralization is a solution for South Africa in fiscal during times of fiscal stress. Put differently, will it lead to better performance and better service delivery? And to answer this question, we used two case studies of re-centralization. We tried to use examples that will reflect administrative re-centralization as well as fiscal re-centralization. So the first case study, we looked at the earmarked conditional grants, which are essentially a ring-fenced pocket of funding within an existing conditional grant that has very stringent conditions attached to it. So essentially, it does reduce the autonomy of subnational governments over its fiscal resources. So it's a subtle approach to centralization. And then we looked at two of these, the finance-linked income subsidy program, the FLIPS, and the upgrading of informal settlements in the mining towns grants. And then the second case study that we looked at was of TVET colleges, which we know that were shifted from provinces to the national sphere in 2012. In terms of our key findings, moving to the next slide, we have three findings. Broadly speaking, we can see that there has been a slight change in the way in which government responds during times of fiscal stress. So if we look at, on a graph, at the period post the financial crisis of 2007-2008, we see that national government is expanding its footprint, which is evident in the strong real growth of the conditional grants relative to a more muted declining growth of the block grants or discretionary funds. such as your PES or your LES. And then if we look, if we now turn to the period, we look at the period from 2015-16 to the current MTF, we see that the response now is quite different. We see that block grants are showing positive growth relative to the conditional grants. But what is most interesting about this is that whilst the number of conditional grants has not grown rapidly, we are starting to see a growth in the EMF grant, conditional grants, which I explained earlier, that these are the pockets of funding within the existing conditional grants that are ring-fenced and have stringent conditions attached to it. So it's more of a subtle approach to centralizing fiscal control over your sub-national governments. Moving on to the next slide. The second finding relates to our case study on fiscal re-centralization. We looked at the earmark funds within the human settlements and related grants. And so with respect to the spending and the service delivery, we found that national governments is not necessarily better at both spending performance and service delivery, which then brings into question the rationale behind re-centralization. So, for example, with this FLIF, we see high levels of underspending. In 2016-17, it was around 76%, and similar performance was evident for the upgrading of informal settlements in the mining towns grants. And then in terms of service delivery, only about 41% of the targeted sites were upgraded. So we're not seeing drastic or better service delivery with these EML funds. Moving on to the third finding, which is derived from a case study of the TVET colleges. As you will remember, that these colleges were relocated to the national sphere in 2012. We evaluated the efficiency of these colleges prior to them being relocated to the national sphere and then post the relocation. And we found that, yes, there were inefficient colleges that then became efficient with the relocation to the national sphere. But what was worrying is that we then also saw some colleges that were efficient prior to the relocation now not becoming efficient post the reform. Thus implying that you can't just take a blanket approach to the reform. It's not an ideal, and it can negatively affect good performance. So based on these three findings, we propose three recommendations. The first being that in a current constrained environment with limited resources, government should not automatically resort to increasing the role of national governments, since the historical performance data does not generally support this. And then to improve service delivery and attainment of specific priority outcomes, control measures other than the implementation of earmarked conditional grant funding must be developed and strengthened. And then our third recommendation is that when re-centralizing a function and when it's deemed necessary, a differentiated approach needs to be adopted. Ideally, government should take a focus on where the weaknesses are within the performance first, instead of applying a blanket approach. If I may please hand over to my colleague who will take us through chapter 3.
Thank you. Chapter 3 of the submission looks at what options or levers are available to provinces, specifically your provincial health department, to cope in times of prolonged fiscal stress. What options do they have to adjust their budgets during times of fiscal stress? And as you know, provinces play a crucial role in the delivery of health care, especially your primary health care. Health allocations comprise around 30-35% of total provincial budgets. And provincial health departments appear to be under severe pressure as a result of massive demand on the one hand and poor growth in transfers on the other hand. It is estimated that for the current 2018 year that the health budget is underfunded by around 13 billion rand. So signs of severe pressure. So the tight fiscal environment places healthcare delivery under pressure, and this analysis then asks what means are available to provinces to respond to the ongoing strain. If we look at the next slide. So we firstly looked at the intergovernmental fiscal arrangements surrounding the delivery of healthcare to see whether it provides scope for provinces to adjust their budgets during times of fiscal stress. And what we found is that the current intergovernmental fiscal arrangement actually limits provincial scope for provinces to adjust their budgets. As you know, a sizable portion of provincial revenue is made up of earmarked national transfers, so this hampers the ability of provinces to adjust their spending priorities in line with their fiscal position. And then also intergovernmental fiscal arrangements limit the scope for provinces to use either borrowing or revenue side measures. As you know, provinces have rather limited revenue-raising powers in relation to municipalities. So it appears that provinces, to a degree, rely on capital spending to smooth out their budget balance. But considering that infrastructure capital spending only totals around 5% of total health spending, this provides a very small cushion for provinces. From an intergovernmental fiscal arrangements point of view, there's very little scope for provinces to do any adjustments to their budget in times of fiscal stress. So then we looked at whether, from a budget perspective, all of the budgets and spending of provinces showing signs of this stress. And we used the budget balance as a measure. And again, if you look at the figure there, it shows the budget balance of three provinces, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape. And it shows little evidence of stress. It shows that the trajectory of the provincial budget is basically, it fluctuates above the threshold of zero, or which indicates a cash balance or even underspending. So this then dispels the notion that provincial budgets are and provincial health budgets are under pressure, but we dug a bit deeper, and what we then found is that if you go to the next slide, please, despite maintaining positive or acceptable budget balances, what provinces are doing, they are actually using expenditure accrual, which is a neat sort of accounting method. That conceals the negative budget balance of a department. So the department it's run out of money. It needs to purchase whatever its medical supplies, etc. And what it does is it commits itself to paying that expenditure with the next year's budget. So it basically has unfunded spending. And what that does is it looks as if they're not overspending, just because of the way they've recorded it. So this is not really a prudent way to plug a fiscal gap, because the end result is just an accumulation of unpaid services, which are recorded as accrued expenses rather than overspending. So instead of understanding that a rise in accruals may be signaling episodes of fiscal stress, what it could be mistaken for is also financial mismanagement by provinces, by the fact that they are committing allocations which in advance they do not have the backing cash to pay for the expenditure of the current year's allocation. So we know that healthcare delivery is under pressure. Provinces are saying that the source of the pressure or the fiscal strain is the result of inadequate transfers and that they need more money. National is agreeing, yes, health budgets are under pressure, but they believe that the budgets are under pressure because of mismanagement or spending inefficiencies. And then you have this phenomenon of growing expenditure accruals across the health sector. So why do provincial health departments do this? And there seem to be two main angles that we have to consider. And the first is that provinces are not allowed to overspend. Overspending is deemed as unauthorized, it's legally punishable, and it can be used as a charge against the department's future budget allocation. So by concealing that overspending, by recording it as an expenditure accrual, they get around that. There's also the constitutional imperatives, or from a human rights angle, when patients present themselves for treatment, even if there is no money, the departments or the hospitals, whatever they